Come on in. Yeah, please do take your shoes off. I'm your host, Whit Schiller, and this episode... Just leave them by the door. This episode of the Improv Comedy Connection is going to start a little differently. We're talking with Kevin Mullaney, who so many of you will know from the Improv Resource Center, the associated podcast that he did, and his outstanding work in developing and delivering great training that's impacted thousands of improvisers. He also was the first artistic director of the UCB in New York, but he again calls Chicago home. Just a quick note for context. This conversation was recorded before COVID-19 and at a time when 2020 seemed like a relatively normal year. So keep that in mind while taking in this discussion that includes a consideration of what Kevin's dream curriculum and approach to improv training would be and what characteristics might be found in a transcendent improviser. But before that, Kevin and I were just catching up. And it seemed to me that the discussion would be meaningful and interesting to other improvisers, particularly people who've done it for a while, to see how improv's fit in Kevin's life has and continues to evolve. So we're just going to drop in on the pre-show conversation, which became part of the episode. But one quick word. Kevin is an outstanding instructor, and he loves to teach and experiment with new things and new students. He mentioned that he's got some increased flexibility to do that in this opening conversation. But let me just say that if you do bring him out, know that you're in store for a great experience and you should pay him accordingly. You'll understand why I've mentioned that as this episode plays out. So let's get into the Kevin Mullaney episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. I feel like there's some things just to kind of have a sense of in terms of what... you know, what you've been sort of focusing on, because the last few years, I feel like you've had a lot of kind of shifts one way or the other in life. So
yeah,
you and I talked the last time you and I spoke on the phone. I kind of remember you talking a little bit about the IRC and maybe trying to develop sort of a bank of coaches or things like that. Do you have some things on your mind or on the horizon that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I mean, my current situation is I'm still involved. I am performing a little bit with my team from the 90s. We have reunited my house team from IO from the 90s, Frank Booth.
Oh, okay.
And we're doing shows.
Nice.
And I'm coaching a little bit. I'm talking to various people about potential, you know, travel to other places.
Yeah.
And doing some teaching at festivals and so forth. But I don't have...
You don't have that home theater anymore, right?
I do not, no. So Under the Gun... I left Under the Gun, it might have been...
2016, was it?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And then I was working on the IRC full-time for a while. And I just had a weird... after about a year and a half working full-time in the IRC, it was going all right. But I felt like... I needed to do something to kind of kickstart things a little harder. I had was thinking about getting to the directing program at Second City. I was teaching there a little bit, thinking maybe I should sort of go all in at Second City. And then they canceled their directing program for that year.
Okay.
Which was sort of weird, bad luck. And then I just got this weird bug. You know how some people... It's kind of like the reverse of what I did. You know, some people, they'll have like a regular job their whole life and they'll be thinking in the back of their head, you know, I wish I would have tried to be a songwriter. I wish I would have started that theater company. I wish I would have, tried to be a comedian or whatever.
Yeah.
Filmmaker. And they sort of have this sort of midlife where they switch gears.
Right.
Well, I did that, but it was kind of in reverse.
Hey. you had a midlife sensibility?
Kind of. I mean, but it really was that same kind of itch where for years and years I had been the thing I was doing in the background, the thing that kind of drove a lot of the things that I created over the years was just this curiosity and this real excitement about web development and computer programming. And I've had a few sort of jobs that kind of touched on it or freelance opportunities that kind of touched on it. And one of the guys I was working with at the IRC got a job. He was a web developer and he got a job teaching at a coding boot camp.
Okay.
So I decided, you know what? Second City doesn't want me. So I'm going to go to coding boot camp. So now I'm working as a developer for about a year and a half. I've been working as a developer.
Okay.
So what does that mean? It means I've got a good job and I've got healthcare,
right.
which for the first time in my life, or not, maybe not the very first time, but it's definitely a really great job. but it means that sort of the improv, like I'm not actively trying to build an improv empire anymore. Now, you know, that may change. I've taken a break from a few things, including my own podcast, but yeah, but I'll probably start ratcheting things up a little bit, trying to find that balance where, you know, where can I do this with a full-time job and what can I do? And can I do some fun things? You know, I especially love it when the opportunities I've had to travel to other countries and do teaching gigs.
Yeah.
And I think one of the, you know, honestly, one of the things about having this job now, it makes it possible for me to not worry so much about the financials of traveling somewhere and teaching. You know, if somebody can, you know, if somebody wants to hire me to go somewhere and it's expensive to get there and they don't think they can make it back up with all, you know, through workshop money alone or, and pay me on top of it, you know, that may not be as much of an issue. Not to say that I would go halfway around the world for free,
right.
but it makes it possible for me to just sort of like, well, if I can just make a little bit of money, but get my expenses paid, I can go to a lot of different places now.
Yeah.
Where the last couple of years before I decided to do this, you know, I was traveling a lot, but it was a little bit more mercenary of like, yeah. I've got to find a way to keep earning money to keep the IRC afloat kind of thing.
Right.
And yeah. And I don't know. Now it's not like that anymore. It's like,
you can make choices.
I can make choices and the choices doesn't have to be it. Like I know some of my friends in Chicago, they quote pretty high numbers if they want to go somewhere and it's because they depend on it. That's the only, you know, they teach improv for a living. And if they take a week off from teaching at Second City, not only is the, you know, the expenses of going somewhere, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, 5 classes they would have taught that week and that's their main source of income. So right. it's important to be able to get a reasonable fee to go somewhere and teach. Whereas, you know, to be honest, I'm not in that position anymore. It doesn't matter as much to me.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't broadcast that.
Well, that was one of the questions, whether that was, you know, it's interesting to just hear you talk about it. And in some ways my follow-up was going to be, is this okay to have as a conversation in the episode?
I think so. I mean, one thing I'm really kind of interested in right now is this there, you know, I've been involved in the improv world for many years and I've gone through different phases. And there was a phase in my life where I was away from, you know, the sort of improv centers. I was living at home, taking care of my parents and, yep. And that was one of the difficult parts of that was this feeling of missing out of like, you know, my friends are in New York, my friends are in LA, many of them are starting to get like actual jobs, like, right. You know, many of them are getting deals or getting shows put up on places like Netflix and elsewhere and Hulu and whatever. And I'm, you know, and I'm back stuck in, you know, the middle of Illinois without, you know, much context without any outlet. Right.
Right.
So there's a period of kind of disappointment along those lines and maybe a bit of jealousy mm-hmm. At times. And I know other people sort of my age who have talked about this as well, but now I'm in a very different place and it's a place I don't quite, it's probably in some ways it's really good because it's like, I don't need to do anything along the lines of improv except the things I really want to do.
Yeah.
A lot of, I think it's very easy. Like one of the things that I got very tired of over the last few years before I decided to go in this other direction was all of the, you know, the self-promotion aspects of being in the entertainment world mm-hmm. were just getting magnified more and more and more. And there's the amount of time I spent running a theater worrying about what we were doing on social media and if we were creating content online so that we could get the word out about these shows, you know, the amount of time and energy spent doing those kinds of things, or the same thing with the IRC of like, right. You know, am I doing these things? Am I writing something on my blog? Am I releasing a podcast episode because I want to do that or because I feel like I have to do that mm-hmm. in order to drive people to find out about my classes and sign up for classes?
Right.
And, you know, that's not why I started blogging about improv. That's not why I started an improv podcast. It was genuinely out of this curiosity. It wasn't why I started teaching improv or why I started performing it.
Yeah.
It never was. I guess the most exciting parts of that were never about business.
Yeah.
They were never about business. So,
yeah.
So it was kind of, I don't know if it was taking the joy out of it, because there was a lot of it that I really liked. Sure. But it was...
Well, there are different activities, right? If you don't enjoy the promotion aspect, or you don't enjoy finding ways to get people to see what you're doing or to know about what you're doing, mm-hmm. that's time spent not doing the things that you like, right? Yeah. And you need those things if that is going to be your primary source of income. But it's a life balance. Because one of the things, and this was not on my radar at all to talk to you about, but I've always seen you as someone who has been just curious about the craft. I think you've always just wanted to see improv itself do well, and see where the art form goes, and probably the least mercenary person about it, probably that I know. And I know from doing a podcast myself, you don't do it because it opens all the doors and money falls into your lap, because it doesn't. Right. 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 The main reason you do it is, or at least for me, I think it sounds similar for you, is you enjoy engaging with people and learning from them and sharing their voices with others. And that's its own reward.
Yeah.
And your podcast is, I mean, it's still wonderful to go back to. And there's episodes that I've listened to multiple times. And if you ever put another one out there, it'll pop up and I'll listen to it right away.
Well, but, I may. That's one of the more likely things that'll get rekindled this year will be the podcast. You know, I was thinking about that recently. And, you know, I think if I'm sort of released from the idea of worrying about the metrics of it, you know, am I getting more downloads this month than I got before? And,
right.
And you know, I started a Patreon for it, right? And,
right.
Which was just way too premature. I mean, I got some people donating, but it's. I think I would sort of take a step back from that idea and really do it because I want to do it, because I enjoy doing it. And when I started the podcast, it was during this period of my life where I was separated from the thing I loved. It was, I was in Illinois. I was away from New York. I was away from Chicago. I wasn't able to perform regularly. I couldn't teach improv because I was taking care of my parents.
Yeah.
And so it gave me this way to sort of reconnect to people and think about improv. And it gave me a lot of great ideas. I mean, the things that I teach now, I can't, you know, some of it, you know, goes back 25 years from when I started improv.
Mm-hmm.
30 years ago when I first started improvising.
Yeah.
But most of the specifics come from the, you know, things I learned since I started that podcast. And it was like taking ideas that people were telling me and reformulating them and trying other things, and also from other classes and so forth. So that process of kind of synthesizing from other ideas and sort of bringing them into my own framework, that was exciting to me.
Yeah.
If I go back to the podcast, it will be for the same reason, because it will be this thing of like, I can't resist that process, and also that way of just sort of communicating with other people. I think it'll be different. I have some ideas of how to kind of change it.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Where were you right before you went back home to take care of your folks?
So I spent 7 years in New York, right?
Yeah.
And I left New York in 2006.
Okay.
And that was the original sort of thing getting me out of New York was, it was kind of taking care of my parents, but it was like a fun way to take care of my dad, which was, he was not doing the best, but he wanted to go, physically. Mm-hmm. He needed to have some surgery. He wanted to have it done at this specific clinic in Arizona.
Okay.
And he was a poker player. As I am.
And
so his plan was to go down to Arizona, rest up all winter, get ready for this procedure they were going to do in the spring, and in the meantime, play poker every day. So it started out with me thinking, well, I'll drive him out there. I don't really want him driving 20 hours across the country by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, when I heard his plan to get a hotel room and just stay in a hotel room for 5 months, I'm like, okay, Dad, we're going to rent a condo for you. There's furnished condos in Arizona and in Phoenix. We're going to find one.
Yeah.
And, not soon after that, I just thought, you know what, why don't I just stay here with you? You know? So yeah. I was his Sherpa for about 5 months, where I drove him to the casino every day. I played poker. He played poker. It was great. I spent 24 hours a day with my dad for about 5 months, you know, the kind of time that I never spent with him as a
kid.
Well,
exactly right. How that is a very rare thing.
He was a workaholic when I was a kid.
What did he do?
Maybe that's not fair, but he was a doctor and he worked long hours. And I then my parents were divorced when I was in middle school. So I didn't, I never lost touch with him or anything, but I didn't spend a lot of time with him.
Not that kind of concentrated thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was great on that level.
Yeah.
But that's when, you know, and that's that year. And I ended up staying in Phoenix longer than that, thinking that maybe I would stay in Phoenix. Maybe I'd go on to LA or whatever. But during that period, my mother got got ill and needed a lot of care. And me and my sisters sort of made a pact to take care of her, which meant me moving back to Illinois.
Okay.
So that's where I was for the next 3 years.
So when you were going through those experiences, like when you're in Phoenix or Arizona, or when you're with your mom, was improv just sort of on a pause button, other than perhaps, you know, some of the podcasts or some things like that? Were you kind of in lockdown mode, or what role did it play in your life then?
It was definitely in lockdown for at least a year after I got back. Like, we were trying to figure things out. We started eventually hiring nurses to help take care of her, which was a bit of a relief, but she was going through a form of dementia that took away her ability to speak.
Yeah.
So it was very hard to, you know, we couldn't just like get a nursing service and take care of her. It was very hard to trust fully.
Sure.
You know, and you know, it, people were wonderful. I mean, you know, the people who helped take care of her with us were wonderful.
Right.
So it's nothing against them, but there were, you know, there were times where it's just like, you know, to leave her alone for, you know, for 12 hours with someone, it's kind of hard. My sister's always hated the analogy, but it's a bit like, you know, leaving your toddler with somebody. You really have to trust them,
mm-hmm.
because they can't tell you if something is wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It would be different taking care of a parent who, you know, is bedridden, but still has their faculties and can still talk to you.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But she couldn't talk to us. So it was very hard to leave her alone.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was one of the reasons I was there. So I was there. My sisters were both there as well, but they were working day jobs. I was not. So the idea was that eventually I was able to sort of go up to Chicago every once in a while, but I wasn't, it wasn't as much as I anticipated. I think when I first went back, I thought, well, it won't be so bad.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be there during the week. And then on the weekends, I will go up to Chicago. It's 3 hours away. I'll go up to Chicago for a night and I can perform there. Maybe I can teach mm-hmm. once a week, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it didn't turn out that way. So it was more sporadic. So I performed a few times. I think I went to the Del Close Marathon once during that period, once or twice.
Okay.
You know, a couple of times I went to New York to teach workshops. So I kept a little bit involved, and that was exciting.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like I anticipated.
Yeah. So let's rewind back to when you get into improv.
Okay.
And I guess I'd like to hear just sort of the progression too, in part, but were you just kind of, once you got into it early on, were you like fully into it, consumed into it, or did it start out as kind of a side dish for you?
Well, it took a little bit. I mean, I got into it because in college, I wanted to be a filmmaker and I realized I didn't know anything about acting. So I got involved, started getting involved in theater at school. Not really classes. I think I took one acting class.
Okay.
But I had a year abroad in London, mm-hmm. and I did a lot of like theater with the student union at the school I was at there. And during that period, I met a guy his name was Seth. He was from a company called Cheap Socks.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly which, they still exist now, I think. It's a college group.
In England, in London?
No, he was from America as well. Oh, he was studying abroad as well.
Okay.
From Boston area or something. He was from the Northeast, or the school was. I can't remember where Cheap Socks was. Anyway, so he taught a workshop. I learned a little bit from him. And I got really excited about improv and thought I would start a troupe at U of I, where I was heading back for my senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down with him one night and he sort of told me everything he knew about improv, which, you know, filled, five pages in a notebook or something. It wasn't
right.
But it was a lot to digest. And he told me about Second City, and he told me about Dell.
Okay.
Assuming actually that Dell worked at Second City, which he did not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so after a couple of years, I moved to Chicago. I was still primarily interested in theater, and I thought I was either going to spend a couple of years in Chicago and, you know, learn about acting, or I was going to spend a couple of years in Chicago and then go off to grad school to do filmmaking.
Okay.
And improv totally messed that plan up. You know, I came to Chicago. I took acting classes. I did a few plays.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, I started doing improv, and just improv very quickly within a couple of years kind of took over my life. I there was a period of a couple of years definitely where almost every single night or every single day, I either was in a class, I was being coached,
yeah.
I was performing, or I was in rehearsal.
Yeah.
Or if none of those were true, I was watching a show.
Yeah, right.
So it was like, it was 7 days a week for a while. And eventually that led into coaching. Eventually that led into teaching. And so I just, you know, kind of went where the opportunities were. I did love it, but no one was offering me, you know, teaching positions for acting. No one was offering me even semi-professional gigs for acting in general.
Yeah.
So plus it was just exciting. I mean, it really felt like you were, even though it was a few decades on, obviously, improv had been around for a while, it really felt like we were sort of creating a new art form, or at least exploring the frontiers of it.
What time frame are we talking about?
So I ended, let's see, I came to Chicago in 91. By 93, I was at IO after taking some improv in a couple other places. And then once I was at IO, most of my improv was there until 99 when I left. And this was a period when sort of, I think this was a period when like Dell kind of flourished. Mm-hmm. You know, he had been with IO for quite a few years, but this was the sort of era where he began directing a lot of shows at IO.
Mm-hmm.
He was always like the last teacher. You know, you would take one or two classes, then you'd take classes with Dell, sometimes for multiple sessions.
Okay.
During this period, it got expanded. So you took like four or five classes before you got to Dell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the community was getting better. Like as your community gains skill as improvisers, I think everybody's skill rises as you can see what other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sort of ensembles that he got to work with, both in his like level six classes and also occasionally with other teams, he would work with other teams and direct shows. The quality of those ensembles got much better. And I think they were able to, you know, starting with the family in the early 90s and all the way through to the end, he was able to finally get people and really get ensembles good enough to kind of do what was coming out of his brain. You know, he would come to class and he would describe this thing like, I want you to improvise like a comic book, or I want you to improvise like a satanic ritual, or I want to get you to improvise like a documentary or something. Like he would just have these ideas that nobody had yet, or very few people had ideas like this.
Yeah.
And then expect his students to be able to do these things. Well, eventually they were able to do these things.
Yeah.
And so I think he was very productive. He created a lot of stuff that was really, really interesting. And we were all watching that and we were all trying to build on it. So yeah, it was an exciting time. And of course, after this period, starting maybe mid to late 90s, things started to spread all over the place. Of course, there was improv in every corner of the US by this point, but school, like theaters that kind of built themselves similar to IO in the sense that they had improv teams and they had regular long form improv shows.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a new thing sort of spreading out from Chicago at that point. And it was really cool to sort of be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that the art aspect in terms of pushing those boundaries ebbed a little bit or reached a certain point where the speed of progress had to go down? Or how do you think improv is moving as an art form today versus at that point?
Well, I think there's an awful lot of things that we were trying that felt very new. Maybe they weren't as new as we thought they were, but they felt very new, that are kind of like the basic language of improv now. So you'll get, so for instance, you'll get groups popping up in sort of mid-sized towns in the U.S. somewhere, and they end up, what are the forms they're doing? Well, they're doing Herald, and they're doing Deconstruction, and they're doing improvised movies, and they're doing the mono scene. And so these are all forms that were either pioneered in Chicago or New York and kind of popularized by various people. It's kind of hard because I think that a lot of the potential space, the sort of natural things to try have been tried. And so that what you have to do next is always, you know, to create something new in that environment, like truly new, is kind of difficult. Sometimes it comes from technology, you know, like there was a show in New York, an improvised movie where they were actually, it was the Neutrino Project, right? And it was, there was a team called Neutrino.
Okay.
And they would get a suggestion. They were on stage in a theater. They would get a suggestion, and then they would kind of vamp for a while, and you weren't really sure what was going on. And then 2 or 3 minutes into the show, someone would run into the theater with a cassette, a video cassette, you know, back in the days when we had video cassettes, a little 8mm video cassette. They plop it in the projector and project it onto a screen. And they had just shot it based on the suggestion. And then as they continued, like people continued to come in, put with these cassettes. And what they had done was they were essentially like shooting a Herald in multiple locations within 50 yards of the theater and sending those tapes back. So it was kind of a innovation based on
the technology available.
The same thing. There's an awful lot of audio improv going on these days. Obviously, people are doing podcasts where they improvise during the podcast.
Right.
Of course, that there was always a little bit of that.
Yeah.
People trying to improvise on the radio or what have you, or you know, going all the way back to Nichols and May improvising on off Broadway and recording their sketches.
Whose Line started as a radio program.
Sure. So there's always been this, you know, this experimentation. So that's one thing that sort of drives it, I think, you know, people thinking, I'm sure there's people trying to think of how to improvise inside virtual worlds. And I know people have tried. So, you know, it's not going to stop, but, you know, as far as a space of like, what can you do on a stage? I think what makes it hard is that the things that truly innovate on stage these days, it takes a lot of effort. And that's something that sometimes improvisers aren't capable of. Not because they aren't dedicated, it's because they have too many things going on. You know, an improviser in Chicago might be involved in 4 or 5 different active projects, including classes.
Right.
And so they're going to be growing quite a bit as an individual. But, you know, the truly innovative groups from years past that I knew of were all groups that were together for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Often they would rehearse for many months, sometimes more than a year before they would ever get on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So, and people, I know people still do that. You know, there are still stories, you know, every few years you'll hear about a group that does that and create something special. You know, the sort of first couple of years of improvised Shakespeare is quite a story, not one I know well, so I couldn't tell you the story, but it's a similar story of working very hard at perfecting something and then putting on stage and doing something, you know, people had been doing sort of improvised Shakespeare games, you know, from the beginning.
Right.
And I'm sure someone had tried to improvise a full Shakespeare play before, but actually doing it on a level that was, you know, truly impressive and repeatable and exciting and... you know, it took a lot of work to make that happen.
And I do think it's probably if you have people who are as divided in their attention in terms of all these different things, as opposed to being able to soak in one particular form or idea or nuance or whatever, it is hard to come up with stuff that like the obvious stuff, like I think you said, has been tried and worked through.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's some element of the concentration of improvisers too that makes a difference? Because it seems to me that we've got all these other places where people, I mean, there's a million places where people are doing improv, but we're not hearing about that thing coming out of left field somewhere, you know, I don't want to pick on a particular city, you know, I don't want to denigrate any improv scene. But, you know, when you hear about Chicago style, or maybe you hear a little bit with UCB being talked about as a kind of a New York style or whatever, we're not finding those in the far corners where someone has done it completely differently in a way that it is going to be accessible and understandable, and that sort of takes off. Does it kind of need to come from those improv centers for a reason?
Well, I think it's easier. I mean, most things that take human creativity thrive in sort of hotbed places, you know.
Yeah.
That's true about music. That's true about dance. It's certainly true about theater, filmmaking. These are all things that kind of, you know, they tend to thrive in certain communities. I don't think there's any reason why there shouldn't be things coming out of other places these days. And I think they're it's probably out there, you know, that we all are kind of myopic about our own experience, I think. And, you know, my experience being in Chicago and New York, of course, I kind of look to those places as, you know, the source of all the things I discovered about improv, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure there's interesting things going on. And the reason I'm sure there's interesting things going on is because when I was at Under the Gun Theater, when I was the artistic director there, we would have auditions. And we were a little bit unique in Chicago in the sense that you could audition for us without ever taking a class from us.
Yeah.
We didn't really have a class system up and running. We offered classes, but, you know, we would never be able to get an ensemble together without accepting people from other places.
Okay.
And of course, we found some people who were, you know, had been in Chicago 1 or 2 years and were working their way through Second City or IO. And we found a lot of talent who that's what their background was. But there were quite a few people who had 5-10 years experience in Atlanta or Nebraska or, you know, other markets for improv that you wouldn't necessarily think of like, oh, improv comes from there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were phenomenal. They were such good performers, and they were going to waste in Chicago in part, or at least at that point in part, because, you know, they had 5 or 10 years experience, but
didn't want to start out at level A.
Well, even if they were taking classes at Improv Olympic, you know, they were in level 2, somebody else was in level 4, and they had status over them, even if they had only started improvising eight months before.
Yeah.
And, you know, it takes a while for people to really take people seriously, I think.
Yeah.
And what happens with somebody like that is that, you know, they end up going through IO, let's say, and they get on a team and they finally start to get recognized as a good performer, and they do something else. And then people, without really ever asking them, assume, oh, you're good because you've been at IO for 2 years. It's like, well, no, they're good because they were at IO for 2 years and they spent 8 years at Dad's Garage in Atlanta before ever coming here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So on an individual basis, I think these other markets are really making a difference. And I think that they are, that must mean in part that the quality of improv at these places, at least some of these places, is getting quite good.
Well, I guess another potential aspect to it is, are we putting improv through too few filters? So as you look at the improv universe, there's certainly a heavy shadow that Adele Close will cast, or a Keith Johnstone will cast, and some others as well, where it's almost like, well, that's how you do it. And sometimes there is a hard time for some people to even synthesize those two schools of thought or approach or whatever. And, you know, there's some aspects that I suppose do conflict with these different schools of thought. But there's also aspects that are just different viewpoints on the same issue. My point, I guess, or the question that I'm trying to ask, though, is part of the problem that we've decided that we need to look through a certain lens, which then you take that performer from Nebraska and then they go through a Chicago filter, where if they had more freedom, maybe they find themselves taking things in a place that that filter wouldn't otherwise allow you to go.
Maybe. I think I look at it a little different, and maybe I need to understand a little bit more what you mean by filter.
Yeah.
I think part of what I'm talking about is just the phenomenon that it's true in Chicago, it's true in New York, it's probably true in LA, that there's a little bit of, you know, wherever you sort of grew, if you grew up as an improviser in Chicago and you go out to LA, you're always going to feel like the Chicago improvisers are better. And the Chicago improvisers that have moved to LA are better than the homegrown improvisers in LA. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Same thing with New York. You know, people, especially at this point where the New York improv scene has certainly proved itself over the years. You know, in the early days when I was there, there was a lot of sort of looking up to Chicago. Obviously, the sort of initial thrust of teachers were all from Chicago.
Right. Well, the festival was the Del Close Marathon. Right.
So there's a little bit of like, I learned it this way, therefore it must be the right way. And I learned it at this place, and therefore it must be, you know, there's kind of this backwards rationalization.
Yeah.
And I think it really, you know, somebody is an actor or let's say a singer, for instance, I'm sure there's things like that happen in other sort of spheres of entertainment. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, you go to LA as an actor and it doesn't matter where you're from, you're going to still go on the same auditions and you may or may not get the gig. Hopefully it's not as, there are fewer opportunities where it's like, we're only really going to consider you if you've already spent 2 years taking classes here.
Yeah.
Like that, I think that's something that's unfortunate in retrospect, something I helped build, you know, I helped build that in New York. I kind of helped, you know, I helped build it on the tail end in Chicago as well. That system, we didn't really have an alternative at that point because there was no one else kind of teaching the skills that we're teaching, but you know, it's got to move beyond that, I think.
So you were the first like official artistic director for the UCB in New York.
Yeah. So when they started the theater, you know, it was the four sort of original members of the original four members that owned the UCB in New York, right? Mm-hmm. And the first teacher they brought out was Armando Diaz. They brought him out to help write their television show, to sort of be in the writer's room with them for their television show and to teach for them.
Okay.
Then I was kind of the next person they brought out. And yeah, for the first couple years I was there, I was basically a teacher, and I directed some shows and helped on a few different sort of projects. At some point they decided we're too busy with the show that they were still doing with Comedy Central. Mm-hmm. We can't make all the day-to-day decisions. We need somebody who's going to be there. Mm-hmm. And so they asked me to be the artistic director. And I was that for about a year and a half, 2 years.
Okay.
Something like that. And then I shifted to be the first kind of director of the training program.
The training program. Okay. So when you are putting together the curriculum or the program, what's the goal, the end goal that you're trying to get to? Because this is maybe part of what I was thinking of a little bit in terms of the filter. So if your goal is to get somebody to be able to do a Harold well, if that's a goal, mm-hmm. well, then you teach to that. And those are things that you measure that you might measure differently if your goal is to get a performer who can be present in any kind of scene. Or if comedy is the goal, that's a different goal than being able to do a certain structure or form well. So when you're putting together a curriculum at the UCB, do you have a conscious goal in mind?
There we did. There we very had a very conscious game plan. And that was to teach Game of the Scene and to teach Harold and to teach those things as one is essential
to the other,
and vice versa. It had some vague resemblances, I think, not more than vague resemblances to the kind of program that was at IO, but it was much more deliberate in the curriculum. It was much more deliberate in its purpose.
When you look at the IO, at least when you were going through it, you know, maybe a little different now, though. What would you have said was the goal, at least as you would have described it?
Game of the Scene was definitely in the program when I was there. I mean, that's where I started to learn it. That's what we talked about all the time when I was a performer there in the early 90s.
Okay.
But it really wasn't, that was not a top-down thing. You know, like Dell wasn't concerned with Game of the Scene. Sharna was not concerned with Game of the Scene.
What would you say they were concerned with?
Dell was always seemed concerned with, gosh, how do I put this? He really wanted to create very, That's such a hard question, because it was very much like just like the ideas that were coming out of his head that he had been thinking about improv for decades and had had some success with sort of getting his ideas on stage. But the real sort of like more complicated versions of things he wanted to see on stage, you know, I think for many years he could only get people to do fairly rudimentary forms of improv where everything was very structured. And the sort of dream he had was a much more kind of, you know, I can't really speak for him, but as I saw it, what he was pushing us towards was this idea of creating form and content and character and ideas, creating all of that on the spot, not just creating premises or creating a character who might interact with another character, but like taking a word or an idea and really creating an entire theatrical experience that's improvised and completely different from the night before.
Yeah, because I've heard people talk about how he had a desire for improv to be considered as worthy of an art form as produced theater.
Oh, certainly.
In some ways, I kind of hear what you're describing is that he wanted to see the technical skill and fullness of an idea that could be, I don't know, I guess what might seem as effortlessly put on display, as opposed to where, you know, if I think about things like Game of the Scene, I think part of it is to have an idea to play with, at least for a while. And it can be more simplistic, and that has its own kind of beauty to it, or can, right?
Yeah. I think one thing about Game of the Scene I think is important is that to understand is that it was rooted in things that happened out of Dell's workshops. I think some people kind of look at it like, oh, Dell wasn't about the Game of the Scene. It was like, well, the Game of the Scene, I think even the terminology for it probably would not have existed without Dell. It was just that by the mid-90s, he was kind of over it. He felt like people were being reductive, I think, when it came to Game of the Scene, and they were creating scenes that were too predictable, and also scenes that did not reflect real life well enough for him. I think for him, when he, and this is just based on a few conversations with him about it, that when he was working on this idea of Game of the Scene, he was viewing it more as a way to sort of bring human behavior and human emotions and human interactions onto stage in the way that many good games are about how two characters interact in maybe not predictable patterns, but patterns.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's true. You know, you look at the relationships you have in your real life. There are patterns of behavior that you see. There are people who tease you every time they see you. There's other people who maybe treat you with great respect every time they see you. And there's other people who don't. Maybe there's a parent or a sibling who can get under your skin with the simplest statement that doesn't even to an outsider even sound like a criticism. But when your mom says it, or your spouse says it or something, it just ticks you off to no end.
Right.
And so discovering that kind of pattern of human behavior and putting it on stage, I think that's where it kind of was rooted for him. And then it became something else that still could be a part of Game of the Scene, but it became something that would drive improv over the years to look a lot more like sketch comedy, I think, than how it would look if you were in Dell's class.
Okay. So maybe more theatrical. Well, I'm not even sure I don't know that that's what you've said either.
His games were, he was interested in stuff that was much more naturalistic, I think, on stage than presentational or.
Can you unpack that word naturalistic? What do you mean by that?
He liked people being themselves on stage. He did not necessarily like polished performers. Sometimes this would be kind of strange for the other students in class. Like you would go to class, right? And there would be the guy in class or the woman in class who is just fantastic, really funny and polished, and they always seem to add something really cool to the scene, especially on the, you know, funny things to the scene. He wasn't necessarily interested in those people.
Okay.
Certainly not the polished, like a polished performer who wasn't very funny. He was much more interested in honest performers.
Yeah.
I can think of a couple people in general, or in particular rather, people who were not good performers who most people would not pay to go see them perform in a theater, but they were brutally honest, and often they had led very difficult lives, and they were willing to get up on stage and talk about it.
Yeah.
And they were willing to get up on stage and perform it, even if what came out was unsettling
mm-hmm.
or not funny at all. Mm-hmm. He was fine with that.
Yeah.
And I can identify with that a bit as it's somebody who taught over many years. You know, somebody comes in and is honest and inject something into your improv class that no one has ever done before, no one has ever spoken about before, you know, that suddenly can be quite exciting from that point of view.
Sure.
But it was not the people that you're, you know, you as peers would think, this is the person we're going to elevate, you know, and sometimes he would build whole shows around that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a class that was together for a while. You know, they had sort of worked their way through IO and they were very good, sort of a very kind of good cohort of performers. And they were working with Dell, and he just brought in one of these performers, these like really honest performers who was also, the word broken is coming into my mind of like
yeah.
somebody who had difficult, upsetting experiences in their life and was willing to talk about it and willing to bring it into scenes and sort of put them in charge of the show in the same way that the early days of the Armando show in Chicago featured Armando Diaz, and he had the freedom to, you know, sort of instigate scenes and be this kind of pseudo deity, sort of making the show happen in the background. He didn't use that power very much, but he gave that same kind of power to one of these other performers, Dell did,
mm-hmm.
in the show. And I think that they kind of looked at it as a challenge that he was setting for them. You know, it was sort of like, can you deal with this? Mm-hmm. Can you deal with this extremely honest, unsettling person who's going to screw with your scenes and is going to give you monologues to that are strange and hard to identify with as your inspiration.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, he was very unlike anyone else I've ever worked with on that level, because it wasn't necessarily, you know, his sort of path to great shows was quite indirect, I think.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. You know, what people ended up doing with his work doesn't necessarily resemble his work.
Yeah. Do you have a picture of where it might have ended up if he had been able to continue?
I don't know. One of the reasons why I'll tell you, the one thing I really appreciate about Sharna is that she gave Dell a place to teach and a place to be the top dog, so to speak, the place where everyone listened to him, right?
Mm-hmm.
He kind of bounced around in different places. He was trying to teach classes on his own. And, you know, Sharna had this, IO was already kind of a small little theater, kind of like a theater sports kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
when she brought Dell on. And I kind of picture him like that is exactly where he should be. He should be sort of at the sort of figurehead, the sort of last teacher.
Well, he sounds like he wouldn't have been comfortable in a different role.
I mean, he tried different roles. He at one point he was the improv consultant or something to Saturday Night Live. He of course directed at Second City a few times over the years.
Mm-hmm.
He taught at other places, but you know, I think Sharna gave him an extreme amount of autonomy to teach exactly what he wanted to teach and do what he wanted to do without, you know, second guessing him or without getting upset with him because he wasn't sort of following the whatever the supposed curriculum was.
Yeah.
And that's, I think he flourished under that. Would he have done other things? I think by this point, if he was still alive, he had so many students that have had so much success. You know, he would have cameos in a lot of Adam McKay's movies. You know, he would be the voiceover of shows on Netflix or Hulu or something. Yeah. You know, he would be doing a lot. He already was starting, you know, he was doing some of that stuff. But when he died in 1999, you know, there were certainly some very famous students of his, a handful of very famous students of his. But if he were still alive through this whole period, the last 20 years, I mean, he'd be in his 90s now, I think, at least his late 80s. He would, there just would be so many people who had gone through his classes that are now in the position of creating shows, writing for shows, directing shows, performing in shows. I'm sure he would have been, he would have done an awful lot of performing along the way as well.
Let me ask you, if you've got sort of full sway over teaching somebody from beginner to pro level, whatever you want to call that finish line, what kinds of things are you looking at in that finished product of an improviser?
Well, it's hard for me to get away from the game of the scene. I think that, that there's a foundation there that's often very exciting. So, for instance, the most exciting teaching I think I've ever done is working with students from New York who are very well versed in the game. Not so I can teach them more about the game, but so that they can kind of, they have that, they can sort of put that in their back pocket, and now we can sort of move on to other things. You know, how can you be more spontaneous? How can you be more real? How can you be more of an actor in the scenes you're doing? Those, the sort of skills that take you from kind of like a funny, awkward improviser who knows the rules to a truly great performer. And you see this with many of the sort of veteran performers, both from that I've seen, at least from Chicago and in New York, even though their paths are different, is that there's, at least with some of them, they gain such a level of trust in themselves and in their fellow performers that they can, even if they're capable of playing really fast, often they slow down and really sort of milk each moment, you know, squeeze the juice out of every moment of a scene and really explore it. I mean, one of my favorite groups over the past 10 years that I've seen perform a couple of times and watch some of their videos online is a group called Dummy. And especially there's a couple of their videos that I just sort of watched several times, like analyzing what they're doing. And it was just this really interesting kind of rhythm that I'm not even sure if they're aware of, where they would find one little thing at the beginning of the show and they would explore that and add to it very gradually and use it to kind of help define who their character is, what their behavior is. And then every couple of minutes, it would be as if the stage opens up or that more lights would come up on the stage, as if there are more to discover about the place that they're in and what's actually going on between the people, so that it might take about 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes to fully understand what the scene was, like who are these people and why are they on stage together, what's actually going on. But during that 8 minutes, when they're sort of figuring all of that out, there's no time where it feels like they're anxious or panicked or worried that the fact that they don't really know, are we brother and sister in this? Or are you my girlfriend? Or or maybe you're just my coworker or my neighbor. Like, I don't know, have any idea who you are. All I know is that we are in your garage and we're talking about the weights that you bought at the yard sale. And that's all we know, is that we're two people. I know we're in your garage. And we're talking about this workout equipment or whatever. And that's all they know at the beginning, right? And they really take their time and they don't worry about it. So even, and I see that with people who've grown up in Chicago, not particularly worried about game. And also in people like the best people in New York, where often they have spent years sort of perfecting this idea of game. And then they kind of get so good at it that they just can leave it behind. They don't, it's just a part of who they are. And they start concentrating on other things, you know, whether it's being a great performer or bringing in other technical aspects of it. So I think that's really like the question is how to get people to that place. Do you teach them the game and then afterwards teach them other things? Or do you, for me, I think that there's a couple of approaches as improvisers that I would love to explore in much greater depth.
Okay.
They tend to be the kinds of things that I teach as festival one-off workshops, and there also tend to be things that I'll bring into the boot camps that I have done over the years, where I take people in for a week. You know, we meet every day for a week and do different exercises every day. So a couple of these things are this idea of improvising from the gut and some things related to that. There's this idea that it came to me kind of late. I've been doing improv for quite a few years, and I had always experienced players who would make surprising choices. Sometimes surprising choices that were really good, that were easy to play with. Sometimes just completely off the wall, you know, like crazy choices that were hard to deal with and that were sometimes worked really well. Like what do we used to call, it was like a type of player, not a loose wire. wish I could remember the term we used, but there would be, you know, this kind
of loose cannon.
A loose cannon, of course. Yeah, it might have been that. So, you know, I think it was fun to, like, when you're creating a team to, like, well, let's put one loose cannon on that team. Somebody who's going to do things that are unexpected. And then the more sort of playing by the rules players will take those weird ideas and turn them into games. But what I realized was that these things that I thought were just intrinsic about certain performers, that they would insert kind of strange behavior or strange ideas into scenes or do things unexpected at unexpected times, that that's completely teachable. It's not, they may not have learned it. The people that I admired who did it well, they may not have learned it in a classroom, but other people can certainly learn how to do it, to force themselves to make choices that are irrational in the moment, to make choices that are unexpected, to react emotionally to things in ways that surprise them themselves. And this really comes from a training comes from this physical theater training that I did when I came back to Chicago.
Yeah.
And it also came in part from ideas that I gleaned from my talking to people for my podcast. I've had a lot of really fun workshops with it. And I know it's affected my own improv in fun ways as well. But I haven't ever had the chance to, like, really work with a group for 4 months or 6 months on these ideas and, like, take these ideas of, like, how do you make these unexpected choices, and how do you, as the other player in the scene, how do you yes and those choices? How do you take those choices and frame them and turn them into a game? How you, as a player, rationalize for yourself? I mean, this is part of the workshop, is you do something unexpected and then you're expected to create a reason why you just did this unexpected thing.
Right.
And we're all experts at this because we do this all the time in our real lives. We don't think we do because it's so subtle, but we do this all the time where something happens and we make a choice in our personal lives and then we rationalize it. Something happens, we get scared and we scream like a child. And then we come up with a reason why, you know, rational reason why this mouse made us do that, or why this person who just came around the corner, this very innocuous person who just came across around the corner made us feel this way. We choose what to eat, you know, we choose to eat something, or we choose to like someone or dislike someone else. And our brain is telling us stories, giving us reasons why we have these feelings, but they're often after the fact. So our brain is really good at making up reasons for why we just did something. And if you start doing really unexpected things, your brain is doing that for you during an improv scene. So you'll make some weird choice and then your brain will come up with an explanation for it.
Yeah. And to me, one of the things I liked about playing with that, both in the workshop and afterwards as well, is that to me, it feels like it gives another tool for you to showcase an aspect of human behavior or how someone reacts to those kinds of moments will be relatable, or at least they can be when the justifications make sense or when someone is doing that, you know, regular brain work quickly on stage without it feeling forced or what have you. But I think it's important too that when you have those kinds of techniques or options that you're putting back on the table, or even something like Game of the Scene, that you have a common vocabulary with the people that you're performing with to be able to do it smoothly.
Yeah. And a lot of these things you can't do or shouldn't do with people you've never improvised with before. Some of them work. You know, making interesting emotional choices often works like a charm, and it doesn't really require that the other person has the same training as you.
Yeah.
I've definitely used that in places where I'm sure they're not thinking about the exercise that I teach and they're perfectly able to play along. Some of the things are a little, like, non sequitur is the kind of thing that really throws some people off, where you just, in the middle of a scene, start talking about something that you haven't been talking about at all. You just quickly change the subject without a segue. That can throw performers off if they're not expecting that. They can sort of react like, you know, why are we changing this? And are you playing a crazy character now or whatever? Like, you know, it can be a little weirdly off-putting. It can work wonderfully if both people know that it's a possibility.
Yeah.
So that would be one aspect of it. Like if I could create my own program, I think bringing this idea into it of how do you create surprise in your own scene work? How do you keep, how do you keep things from being predictable? And it's, I think it's a, an excellent way to kind of feed this idea of game. Mm-hmm. But there's other aspects. I think, you know, all the way from the beginning, you know, I was taking acting classes very seriously before I took improv classes or while I was taking improv classes in the early days. And I've returned to that over and over again. And I think there's an awful lot to learn from different schools of acting.
So when you say you've returned to it, what do you mean by that?
Well, I went through a program when I first moved to Chicago, a program that was kind of Meisner-based acting program.
Mm-hmm.
When I returned to Chicago, part of my plan was to get involved in the sort of regular theater and act and plays as well. And so as part of that, I was going to take one or two classes. I ended up going through this whole other program called Black Box Theater here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I also went through a program or took classes for quite a few months with someone who taught this very physical style of performance that it somewhat clown-based performance, something that if I had been exposed to it in the early 90s when I was starting, I just would have rejected it and been like, I don't want to do anything that has anything to do with clowning.
Right.
But it was fascinating and it gave me an awful lot in terms of being a better performer.
What were like some main takeaways?
I think one of the things that she taught me was how to be present in my body in a way that a lot of improvisers and just regular actors are simply not, in the especially in the U.S. Once you're sort of aware of it on a conscious level, it becomes really distracting. You'll go to the theater and you'll watch people as actors and they will be very... they'll have a very noodly body is one of the things that I see all the time where they're just not, they don't seem to be in control of their body. They're sort of shifting back and forth and their arms are noodly and they don't really, they have no sense of what they're doing, you know? And it's very, sometimes it can sort of, they'll have like a very similar kind of flaccid energy for a large portion of the scene. And it can just, you know, it, you can get bored and you can get, you know, distracted. In, I just was really surprised at like how much of a difference it made in my own performance, just to sort of, and in other people's performance, to just be really present in your body. It's one of the reasons why I think dancers are so amazing when it comes to being performers. And I never realized that before. So for instance, there was a person who auditioned for us when I was back at Under the Gun. And she came on stage. She was very present. She was fine as an improviser. I knew she was funny because she had helped. She had worked on a show of ours. And we're like, oh, yeah, we've got to have her on the ensemble. So we cast her and she was going to be a part of the ensemble. And it was only at that point when we actually looked at her resume. It's like she hasn't done any improv. She was a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that training as a dancer, it was just like, she gets on stage and she knows how to be present and just in her, it's kind of hard to describe, but very present and very deliberate in her movement. Not in any way that feels showy.
Right.
It's just that when she's standing there, she's standing there.
Yeah.
When she moves across the stage to sit down, she moves across the stage to sit down. It's there's not this kind of wandery, flimsy, shifting back and forth on your feet energy.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things. The other thing was just, was this some ideas about, again, an idea I would have rejected in my 20s about mask work and how the idea of a neutral mask or your face as being a neutral mask, where what's most important about that is simply to keep it open to the audience, to keep breathing so that you're, if you do have any emotional reactions, they register very clearly for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's sort of hard to explain. If you want to see it in action, watch Letterkenny.
Letterkenny? Okay.
Letterkenny, it's this Canadian sitcom about these kind of hicks in rural Canada.
Okay.
And, you know, there's sort of the hicks and there's the hockey players and there's the goths. And I think it evolves quite a bit over the seasons. I've just watched a few shows. But I noticed that the main characters, they have this kind of neutral mask. Like they're not, they are, you know, they're firing off their dialogue very fast. It's It's not like highly stylized in the way that they move and stuff. But if you're aware of like clowning, you're suddenly really like, they are present in their body in the way that a lot of actors are not. And I think it really affects the comedy in a positive way.
Hmm.
So that would be another aspect. If I was going to start my dream studio,
mm-hmm.
it would not be improv only. It would require people to take dance. It would require people to take Meisner. It would require people to do physical theater, and it would require people to do improv. And you would do all of these things to varying degrees and sort of mix them together. I think, honestly, we were talking earlier about like what is new to explore in improv. And I think the really important thing, if you want to explore new things in improv, is do something else besides improv.
Right.
Get out there and take a clown class. Get out there and take acting classes or circus classes or filmmaking classes or music or something, and then bring it back to what you're doing. Every good idea I ever had when it came to improv, you know, in terms of form or structure, or almost always came from some experience outside of improv.
Well, and that was a consistent question or theme that you would ask in many of your episodes too. What people were doing outside of, or if they could bring that thing into improv, what would that right. look like? And a lot of really interesting thoughts and ideas came out of that. Well, I've gotten to 10%, and we started before we started in some ways. So Kevin, there's a lot more things to talk about that I'd love to return to at some point, but I feel like if I don't watch the clock, this will be a 2-hour thing. I do really appreciate the where we started, that you're doing what you're doing in improv because it's what you want to do, what drives you or draws you. Always had a fantastic experience with what you do, and you've given so much to the improv community. So it's really a joy just to chat with you for a while. I'll make sure people know how to get a hold of you, and as those next things kind of develop, let me know, and I'll make sure others know too. And KevinMulaney.com is a good place to go for all these things as they develop too, I would think.
Yeah, I'm sure if I start teaching more regular classes, which I might this year, it'll show up at KevinMulaney.com, and also probably my Twitter. Twitter is probably the best way to kind of keep an eye on what I'm doing. And that's it. IRC Mulaney is my Twitter handle.
All right. Well, again, thanks for the time, Kevin. This has been great.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's lots to consider in that conversation. I appreciated the discussion about the evolution of Game of the Scene and how its original and maybe best purpose is to illustrate human behavior and patterns of human behavior, as well as how it might be best to view it as a tool and not an end goal in and of itself, or at least to recognize that game can get over-prioritized. If you've worked with Kevin before, you know that he loves exploring ways to draw out more of the human condition on stage. That should lead to more funny as well, as audience do laugh and appreciate seeing real human interactions play out. Going back to the pre-show conversation, I appreciated seeing how Kevin is finding the right place for improv in his life over time. I think it's very healthy to have a sense of what space improv should have in your life so that it doesn't crowd out other personal interests or experiences for you. And if managed well, improv can be a continuing source of joy for decades. But he's still teaching, so bring him out and pay the man, would you? You can look Kevin up at KevinMulaney.com and at the Improv Resource Center. And as he said, at IRC Mulaney on Twitter is a good way to keep up with what he'll be up to in the future. Thanks again for riding along with me here in Season 3. I'm always open to your feedback and suggestions. Just send them to me at wit@improvcomedyconnection.com or online through the podcast pages or accounts on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. I've got great guests lined up for much of the rest of this season already, but I'm already planning on how I might approach Season 4 and perhaps another special episode or two. And I'd love to factor in your voice as I'm doing this to be of help to you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. Thanks for continuing to let me share these experiences with you as your host on the Improv Comedy Connection. My name again is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fishsticks Comedy. You can check us out at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also go to whitschiller.com for additional content and resources to help you in your comedy or communication journey. Thanks again for tuning in to the Improv Comedy Connection.